edited later anyway.
Yeah.
So don't miss the early parts of sentences.
While we're chewing.
That's right. While we're chewing.
Mm.
So we could talk about, definitely talk about that for half an hour.
Mm.
And then we could have a break and it'd be good to come back to some of the...
Every day it comes down ready to start writing the great book.
That's right. Well, you've already written quite a few chapters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always new though, Michael.
It is, that's right.
Bugger.
Yeah.
Never say the same thing twice. It's not fun.
So when did this insight begin for you? This insight into Johnson's challenge, really, to Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, the current insight relates to the dwarf, Nano.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's in a sense seeing him as a chorus figure. You know, one who's got wisdom.
Yeah.
And he's given the voice of the author.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but very inconspicuous in the play. In fact, I doubt that the characters, there are these three characters, Nano, Androgyno, and Castrone.
Yeah.
And you can imagine that they're meant to be odd.
Yeah.
In 1605, 1606, they had to be identified as the kind of the fool presence.
Yeah.
And so they don't have much to say in the play.
Yeah.
But it's in the very middle of the play, in Act 3, Scene 3, that they have this stepping out of the life of the play with a sort of gratuitous scene in which the three of them say, which of the three of us would receive the favours of our master?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it became a competition among them as to who was the favourite.
Yeah.
Well, of Volpone, I guess.
Yeah.
And as it happens, that in a way is rehearsing the basic plot of the play.
Yeah.
Which is this play about how a man gives out news that he's about to die and it attracts would-be heirs. They come running with gifts of money, gold and all these things to buy themselves into his will.
Yeah.
And of course he's fleecing them.
Yeah.
He's not dying at all.
Oh.
So he just receives all their gifts. And so it's a classic study of avarice, greed, wonderful study of greed. And so Volpone's there as the great trickster, the sort of fox-like or wolf-like presence and sucking them in. But it's manipulated by Mosca, the servant, who's the brilliant genius of the play.
Yep.
Anyway, he's the man who stands for Ben Jonson, or the author. It's as though he's stage managing the play. And in that sense, you can compare him with Hamlet, who also does that kind of stage managing of the drama.
Yeah.
At least got that kind of self-consciousness, or self-awareness of what's happening, what might happen. And I mean, we've heard it said that actors think of Hamlet and Mosca as the two great roles on the stage, Jacobean stage. And you can understand why if you give this sort of insight into the character who somehow plays the author in the play.
But these three characters, Nano
Androgyno,
Castrone, you've talked about the fact that they in some way mirror the three daughters in Lear. This is a parody, perhaps, of the Lear situation.
Yeah.
And yet you've said that there's something fundamentally different in the way that Jonson has created these characters and their significance for continuing theatre.
Well, I think that's the big topic to take up.
Yeah.
Just in what sense there's a relationship between Old Pony, the play, and King Lear, the play.
Yeah.
As in a sense, I mean, my approach would presuppose that Lear was put on first.
Yeah.
And obviously a great success, although there's no reference to Lear much in the literature about the theatre. We don't know exactly when it was put on, but 1605, 1606 is the time. And my sense of Old Pony as being an imitation, a Johnsonian imitation of the world of Lear.
Yeah.
But rewriting it in radically opposite ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Johnson must have sat there watching production of King Lear and almost laughing his head off at it. I mean, he saw this old man who gets dignified by misfortune, you might say, as a fool. Not just as a fool, but as a conniving old man who wants to control life.
Yeah.
And so he had a very sardonic view of King Lear, which I don't think any staging of Lear ever goes near.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of virtually mocking Lear for his
We talk about his folly,
but not really being driven by the desire to control.
A huge ego.
Even beyond his own death. Beyond his own reign.
Yeah.
Johnson drew this very critical perception of King Lear and that whole compact of Lear and his daughters.
Yeah.
Is in a sense mirrored in this whole play of Volpone, where you get the basic situation, which keeps on coming back as a running gag, you might say, in the play. It's a very long play, big five actor.
Yeah.
Volpone, and this basic thing of Mosca manipulating the three men not to meet each other.
Yeah.
He has to keep them separate, but he gets involved in plots with each one.
Yep.
And that all ultimately will collapse.
Mm.
And the final big scene in the law court.
Yeah.
But that's the basic structure of Volpone.
Yeah.
This running gag about manipulating these three would-be legacy hunters.
But the other aspect that you've spoken about is the fact that Ben Jonson, in creating a figure like Nano in particular, tends to defuse the mythic element of Shakespeare and bring it into the level of ordinary discourse, and in a sense leads its way into the development of the novel in the 18th century. And
Well, this is, I mean, today, you know, the word Nano is on virtually everyone's lips.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go near Silicon Valley.
Yeah, nanoparticles.
Everywhere you can see the whole principle of reduction of scale.
So how does that apply back to Johnson? How do you see that kind of working back into history there?
Well, from a dwarf's eye view of the situation.
Yeah.
He's, has no illusions.
Yeah.
He has no beliefs, possibly. He's a figment of a world's playfulness. So he sees things small. And the thing that interests me most, of course, is that there's a kind of deep movement going on in late Elizabethan Jacobean London with Francis Bacon.
Yeah.
And Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson came to idolise Bacon.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the most severe critic of his contemporaries, you can imagine. But he wrote some very positive lines about Bacon.
Yeah, what was he celebrating Bacon for? How did that view of Bacon connect with his creation of Nano, for example?
Well, the very idea of the essay form.
Yeah.
This is comes from France. Who wrote the essays in
Montaigne.
France? Montaigne, just 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
So it was current. But an essay, by definition, is a reduction of things into small units.
Yeah. Mm.
You can talk about truth, you can talk about nature.
Yeah.
If you've got the gift to conceptualize.
Yeah.
And create coherence, there's kind of tension and denseness in a little thing.
Yeah.
That can say much.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think that's the principle that's going to evolve in 17th century into what we call, you know, the age of
reason, enlightenment.
Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And so I see Bacon and Johnson, 1598, as triggering off an alternative mindset.
Yeah.
Whereas Shakespeare can take the dying of a king or old men dying and mythologize them. And they have great, great wisdom.
Yeah.
That's given to them through, which is wonderful.
Through their suffering, through tragedy.
Yeah, especially through their tragedy and through their dying.
Yeah.
It's like a post-mortem consciousness.
Yeah.
He gave John of Gaunt with that great deathbed speech.
Yeah.
In Richard II, this great vision of England.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh, wait.
Sorry, I wasn't here.
That's all right.
We're doing okay.